I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection. Ever since the U.S. started talking about invading Iraq, it's been talking about planting those seeds of democracy. Last spring, even as the smoke of the battle still hung over the capital city, Baghdad, those agents of democracy started arriving. They came with great hopes as returning exiles or as U.N. bureaucrats, artists, academics, and engineers ready to help Iraqis rebuild a responsible system of government. Today, many of those people have left Iraq, taking their hopes with them. Instead of witnessing the birth of a democracy, they experienced a year-long litany of deprivation and kidnappings and car bombings and news from Fallujah and al-Sadr. The same goes for those in the United States who supported the invasion of Iraq in the name of human rights. Today, they're looking at photographs, new photographs from Abu Ghraib, and wondering what went wrong. Well, in just 40 days, the U.S. is to formally hand over control of Iraq to Iraqis. So here's our question. Have your views on the war changed? Has the violence of the last several months challenged your opinions about the war or confirmed them? And do you see any signs of an emerging democracy in Iraq? Our number's 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. And joining us this morning, Michael Ignatieff. He is director of the Carr Center for Human Rights at Harvard's JFK School of Government. Michael has a new book out. It's called The Lesser Evil, Political Ethics in an Age of Terror. Michael, it's nice to have you here.
Nice to be here, Dan.
And we're also joined by Amal Rassam. She's a retired professor of anthropology from the City University of New York. She spent the last year in Iraq trying to help build a civil society in the capital city of Baghdad. She returned to the U.S. last week. She's joining us from a studio in Fairfield, Connecticut. Amal, it's nice to have you back on the program.
Thank you.
And I say back on the program because when we last spoke, it was November, and you had kindly invited me to a meeting of the Mansour Advisory Council, one of the neighborhoods of Baghdad. And I want to, just for our listeners, but also for ourselves, Amal, listen to one of the things that you told me back then in November.
It's a process, and I believe that we've got to start with the process. And it's a learning process. It's also a process that, I mean, I think the Iraqis are tired. They are frustrated. They've had a very generation has not had any options or chances, and we're not going to have it tomorrow. There is no such thing as having democracy tomorrow. But ultimately, democracy is not the monopoly of any group or any country. It's a human right.
Tired, frustrated were the words that you used to describe the people. But the people were still coming to the meetings. You were still holding the meetings. At that time, Amal, unless I missed my judgment here, you were still pretty optimistic about what could be accomplished.
That's very true. I was enthusiastic, optimistic, and I believe that I had very good feedback from the people with whom I was working and the people I was mobilizing. What has happened is, I should say, by beginning of April, I became like those Iraqis myself, being, of course, an Iraqi too. I became frustrated and almost hopeless and helpless, or feeling helpless. Besides, it became by March, end of March, very difficult to keep doing the work that we were doing.
Just physically difficult to get to a meeting, you mean?
Absolutely. It became physically dangerous, despite the fact that, you know, we started to work with heavy security guards and unmarked cars and so on. But both for me and for my team, the Iraqi team, I had about 30 Iraqis whom we had trained to work with us on these councils and this democratic initiative. It became dangerous, risky for them to also to go out in many, many areas, some areas more so than others. So I was by then, of course, it was almost impossible to do the work in a sense, but also I began to feel, less optimistic, at least in the short term.
And just before I turn to Michael, Amal, the people, those people that you introduced me to, people like Imad Saleh, Mohammed Sirwan, mm-hmm, Saeb mm-hmm. al-Ghilani, now are they also feeling significant levels of despair over what it is they can accomplish? Are they giving up?
Absolutely. I think their own enthusiasm has also is no longer there. Some of them have actually given up. We lost many members
They received threats. They were frustrated at the lack of cooperation they were getting from the CPA in many areas. They themselves, some of them are persevering. I know Imad is still working. Many others are still working, but the conditions for them and their attitude has certainly changed. And I'm really not sure what's going to happen in the next, you know, month or two as far as these councils
go. I don't think anybody knows the answer to,
exactly,
to that question. Michael
exactly.
Ignatieff, you grounded your support for this war by telling us to set aside 9/11 and not to focus on the neocons and not to get distracted by the weapons of mass destruction and Bush and Cheney and Bush's father and all that part of the political debate that preceded the war, and said, focus on the people, focus on what's best for the people. You listen to what Amal has gone through over the past year. It's not new to you. You're hearing the same thing from your contacts over there. And all the latest news and photos and stories of abuse seem to put the lie to anybody's notion that it was ever about the Iraqi people.
I have to listen to what Amal says with the deepest respect. She's taken enormous personal risk, showed great courage in working for democracy from the bottom up. But we have to put what she's gone through in context. There is a really vicious, concerted counterinsurgent campaign whose purpose is to wreck the democratic hopes of the Iraqi people. I think the wrong conclusion to draw from this is that, you know, somehow democracy is impossible. What Amal said when she talked to you in November was, you know, why should we think that, you know, a great and historical people like the Iraqis aren't capable of democracy? No, they probably want democracy as much as ever, but you can't build democracy without security. And there are people out there who want to simply destroy any possibility of a democratic transition. And I think, to be frank about myself, I certainly underestimated the viciousness and strength of that campaign. But do I think that democracy is impossible in Iraq? Well, Amal's got more authority on this matter than I do. All I know is I was up in northern Iraq at the beginning of April, and I saw the Kurdish political leadership. They're not perfect Democrats. I'm not a sentimentalist about the Kurds, but they've achieved an incredible amount in 10 years. They have extraordinary achievements in self-government up there. They show what Iraqi people can achieve if they're given minimum security conditions. So I don't want to sound kind of, you know, foolishly optimistic. It's as bad as Amal says it is, I'm sure. But I still feel, what other alternatives have we got here? I mean, do we want to hand Iraq back to the Ba'athists? Do we want to hand it back to the people who blow up the democratic aspirations of the people? All I can see us doing is, you know, we either cut and run, or we try and keep faith that the original faith seems to me to have been the right one, which is to keep faith with the simple proposition: this is the first chance in a generation for 26 million Iraqis to live some kind of decent life.
Let's, though, if we can, try and put our finger on what has not worked in the past year. And for that, Michael, I want to go back to one of our first conversations about this particular set of circumstances. I was in Baghdad in April. You were sitting in the chair that you're sitting in right now. And we were talking about the looting and the difficulty that people were going through in Baghdad at that time, and you put the U.S. responsibility at that point very clearly.
Militaries are useless at other things, but they are very good at going house to house and saying, your Kalashnikovs, please, your grenades, please, if you're a political party, no guns, please. This is where you have to use sheer raw power, and you do so to get the guns out so that politics can be clean and politics can be nonviolent. And if they can achieve that in the next, you know, 9 months, that'll be great. If they let that slip, if they let weapons consolidate in the hands of the political parties and tribal factions and religious groups, then you have the makings of civil war.
And I go from what you said last April to where we are right now, and you ask, what's the alternative to democracy? And maybe it is civil war. Maybe it is the Kurds looking after northern Iraq and the Shiites looking after the south, and you know, the devil take the center. That's also a possibility, isn't it?
Oh, it's an emphatic possibility. And, you know, the plain fact is that America has lost its capacity to create good outcomes in Iraq. The only thing American force can now do in Iraq is prevent the worst outcome, which is civil war. We are not, in fact, at civil war. We don't have, you know, Shia fighting the Kurds en masse. But we do have substantial resistance in the south. We've got the Sunnis in a basically a Sunni-wide uprising. These are not just dead-enders. The grim truth around Fallujah and these places is that America has nearly lost control in that area. So we could get to civil war, but we're not at civil war. And the one thing, you know, I think we need to focus on is that the outcomes from here on out are not determined primarily by the Americans. They're determined primarily by the wisdom, political sagacity, and courage of the Iraqi political elites. I saw plenty of courage and sagacity in the Kurdish political elites, who could already have marched into Kirkuk and started the civil war and haven't. You look at a guy like Ayatollah Sistani trying to hold the Shia together, trying to keep them from tipping into civil war. What's holding this whole thing together is not the Americans, in fact, who made every possible mistake, but the wisdom of the Iraqis. And all I plead is that we don't give up on them.
Amal Rassam, your own Iraqi roots run deep on this, and I just wonder if there was a point in the last weeks that you were there in Baghdad when you stopped defending what you believed the best intentions of America were going to be, when there was a time when you thought to yourself, I can no longer stay. Yes, I know the CPA is sloppy, you're doing this badly, but...
Well, you know, people like me were in a very, very difficult position in Iraq. We are accused of being collaborators, of agents, of being there for the money that we're getting from the United States. People are very suspicious in Iraq, given the last 30 or even more so years. And we were in a very, very, as I say, a very difficult position. On the other hand, despite that, and despite the fact that we were also seen as the sort of the mouthpieces, in a sense, for the many times we were assumed to know what's going on with the CPA and with Bremer and the people around him. We were always being told by the people, go and tell Bremer that, go and do that. Why don't you do this? Why don't they do that? It's interesting that at the beginning we tried to be the sort of cultural brokers, if you like, between the CPA and the United States in general and the Iraqis, because one of the big problems, in my opinion, something which is very well known, is the lack of, I think, concerted effort by the CPA, especially in the first 4 or 5 months, to really, really reach out in terms of communicating to the Iraqi people. Not just to the so-called returnees, the elite who were in exile, but to the average person on the street. The Iraqis were clueless about what the CPA intentions are, who they were, what they were doing.
I need to stop you there, Amal. We're going to take a short break. We'll come back. We'll talk more about just exactly what was lacking in the communication there and whether or not it is, in fact, now up to the Iraqi elites. Has America lost the opportunity to bring any version of its own democracy or ideas of democracy to Iraq? Is the credibility so shot that they no longer want to listen to that coming from Americans? We're at 1-800-423-8255. I'm Dick Gordon. You're listening to The Connection from NPR. I'm Dick Gordon. You're listening to The Connection from National Public Radio. The number to join our conversation this hour is 1-800-423-TALK. And we're discussing the democratic enterprise in Iraq. We are just 40 days from that moment when the United States has promised and promised again to hand over sovereignty over Iraq to Iraqi hands. Michael Ignatieff is here with me in the Boston studio. He's director of the Carr Center for Human Rights Policy at Harvard, author of a number of essays and books. His most recent one's called The Lesser Evil, Political Ethics in an Age of Terror. Amal Rassam is also with us. She spent the last year in Iraq working as a contractor with the North Carolina-based RTI International, helping to build civil society in Baghdad. She was born in Mosul, raised in Baghdad, is now a retired professor of anthropology from the City University of New York. We're going to take our first call from Raleigh, North Carolina, and Don's joining us on the phone. Hi, Don.
Hi, Dick. I just wanted to make a comment. When this whole thing first started, I had a lot of sympathy with these neocons or whatever you want to call them. And I still do. I think, America could exercise power in such a way as to do great and good things in the world. But the monumental lack of foresight and planning that's been shown, and it's just, I'm disgusted with the whole thing. And as far as democracy taking root in Iraq, I don't think it's a seed that we're going to be able to plant. It doesn't look that way to me from what I see on the, on the TV and here on the news.
So what's the U.S. responsibility now, Don, to leave?
We can't leave. We can't leave immediately. We're stuck. And I don't want to see Iraqis lose their lives. I don't want to see American soldiers lose their lives. And these terrorists seem to have a better grip on things than we do.
Well, I think at the moment we are not winning. I don't know whether the terrorists are ahead of us, but I certainly agree. And I think your comment captures the anguish the country is now feeling about this. We have made a promise to Iraqis, that is to give them a better life. We seem unable to deliver on the promise. Cutting and running seems to betray that promise and expose them to a really dreadful fate. I mean, you've summed it up. I think the difficult issue here is whether someone like me, and I supported the war, should have known that this administration would not plan, would not care about execution of the plan, would not have a proper strategy to transition for democracy. A lot of people are now saying to me, you should have known. These guys would never be able to deliver the promise. That's the thing that I revisit quite a lot, whether I was naive in supporting a team that I should have had much less confidence in.
But your defense to that, if I recall it, was that it doesn't really matter what the intentions are. It's the consequences that matter.
Well, that's what I revisit. I think that some of the intentions were so lousy. That is to say, if you look at things like interrogation policy and detention policy, I mean, I just think this administration didn't care about the Geneva Conventions, cared only about results, didn't understand the strategic catastrophe that would unfold when soldiers, as they were bound to do, would release mm-hmm. photographs of these atrocities. This is an administration, I think, that simply didn't have any of the intentions necessary to do this job right. And so, I mean, if I made a mistake, and I think this is where it lies, I didn't pay sufficient attention to these intentions, and I think the intentions were pretty terrible.
Yeah, go ahead, Amal.
Please. Just a small interjection here. When we speak about the planting the seeds of democracy, and I, certainly this 1 year with a lot against very rough conditions, I really tried to do that, and I found an incredible receptivity. Initially, there was a lot of cynicism, a lot of what is this all about? We want electricity, we want jobs, we want clean streets, we want water, and so on. And there is reception to the idea of, however you want to, I mean, democracy in the sense of representation, having control over one's destiny, public decisions, and so on. But I think what we have to keep in mind, and I am looking at it from the bottom up, from the point of view of your average citizen, one thing which I don't hear people speaking about, especially now with the scandal, the Abu Ghraib and so on, is the experience of the average Iraqi in this last year. There has been a lot of racism. I'm sorry to have to bring this up, but I think it's something that we ought to sort of look at, experienced by the Iraqis. Which I don't think they expected, having been, if you like, I mean, we speak a lot about this is not part of our American values to treat, people like this, which is true, obviously. But there, I have seen myself a lot of racism and discrimination. There's a lot of
You're
corruption.
Not just talking about the prisons, though. You're talking about something more subtle.
No, I'm talking in general. Yes, in general. I worked very closely with both the military and the CPA. And I'm not generalizing to all, but certainly there, in my experience and in my own presence, a lot of racism exhibited. It has to do with maybe lack of adequate training that was given, but this does not generate, you know, goodwill. There's a lot of corruption going on, both at all levels, the Iraqis and the non-Iraqis, big and small corruption. There is, of course, the lawlessness that is rampant, not just all over. People are, and the unemployment. So given all these together, I don't know how reasonably we were really expecting democracy and civil society to flourish. If you cannot be safe to go to a council meeting or to go to an NGO meeting, you're scared to do that. Or your child, if they go to school in the morning, you're not sure they're going to come back at night. They may be abducted for ransom, or your daughter will be kidnapped and raped. I don't know. You know, the democracy initiative becomes a very difficult, more so than one expects.
You put actually a very practical face on something that Michael has spent a lot of time writing about, and that is the possibility, the likelihood, the effectiveness of an army to go in and try and do good in a situation exactly like we have seen. And we should just talk about Baghdad here, because obviously there are many different parts of Iraq where the situation's unfolding quite differently. But Michael, one of the words that you frequently use there in terms of trying to define, you know, where you can use force for good is dignity. And that's exactly what Amal is talking about, is that there was none of that sense of dignity in the sort of
absolutely
two
absolutely
cultures coming together.
It's not power per se, because the Iraqis respect power, like, but it has to be also coupled with, as you say, dignity and a certain respect for pride, which is a big factor, cultural factor. You know, rightly or wrongly, I don't, you know, that's the way it is.
I think Amal's raising a very painful and very real subject, which is she uses the word racism, but goes by other names, a sense of contempt for Iraqis, a sense of disrespect for their culture, a sense of indifference to their religion, a sense that they're not fit for democracy, a sense that they're not fit to be collaborators in co-workers in a democratic project. I think there must be a lot of that. I haven't seen it myself. The students I teach at the Kennedy School, many of whom saw active service in the war and were in Iraq afterwards, I think were free of those attitudes. But if Amal saw it, it was there. And the disturbing question is whether that's a necessary accompaniment of any coercive military operation in a foreign country where you don't understand, you don't speak the language, you can't, as they say, tell the friendlies and the unfriendlies apart. You start to get fearful of your security, and the
Absolutely.
Natural trust we have starts to break down. You take a shot from a crowd of Iraqis, and suddenly all Iraqis are the enemy. This stuff happens very, very fast, and it's one of the reasons, I think, why America has reached the end of the good that it can do there. My view is that it can prevent civil war, and it can hand the political process off to the UN to try and drive the process towards a democratic outcome. But the bitterness, the mutual dislike, the mutual distrust is now so great that, with the exception of the Kurdish North, and that's an important exception, mm-hmm. where Americans are still trusted and respected, with the exception of the 4.5 million Kurds, I think America has lost moral credit with the Iraqis. And I think that's a terrible confession to make, but that is, I think, what Amal is saying, and I from this safe distance, I'd have to agree.
I want to go back to our callers. Our number is 1-800-423-8255 to Westwood, Massachusetts now, and Mudaffer is joining us. Hi, Mudaffer. Thanks for calling.
Hi, how are you, Mr. Zay?
I'm fine.
Hello to your guests as well. I am an Iraqi myself, and I fought Saddam Hussein in 1991. And what your guests are describing is details of the nature of occupation. Occupation by nature is against people, is disrespecting people. Is it trying to claim that they have the privilege to tell people what to do, how they govern themselves, how they be what they supposed to be? So the nature of occupation never been for people as much as against people. This is number one. Number two, I mean, the objective of the war wasn't to liberate Iraq, and this illusion has to be diminished, because it's been running in, within the media cycle for too long. Liberation Iraq doesn't come by forcing or killing or even manipulating Iraqi population into sectors, and each one of them trying to win the American side so they will gain power in terms of the future political process, like what's happened with the Kurds. And also not
Mudaffar, let me just stop you there for half a second, because when you're talking about the occupation, and nobody shies away from using that word. Now Bremer uses the word or has used the word pretty well since he took that office. Do you think that on the 30th of June, when some piece of paper is passed the Iraqi Governing Council and the American forces say, look, we're going to be around if you need us, that it ceases to become an occupation then?
So if you just let me say what I mean, I am in contact with most Iraqis at home in Baghdad, everywhere. Iraqis are not foolish. They know that this talk about sovereignty is just a form of lies. I mean, there is no real sovereignty when you
Absolutely.
Have foreign power occupying the country, manipulating, disrespecting even the intellectual or the intelligent of the country, not allowing people represented by people, by the majority of people, to be the main power. The main
okay, Mudaffar, just hang on half a second. I want to bring Amal in, because, Amal, you're saying absolutely that nobody believes anything's going to change on the 30th of June.
No. I mean, they don't think that whether it's, a half a sovereignty is going to be handled. Right? No, everybody believes that this is not going to take place, not with military bases being built all over, established all over Iraq, not with the... Or they say, well, the CPA is not going to be there, but it's going to be called the American Embassy. And it's 3,000 people or 2,000 people, the same people, are going to have different titles and in the same place except for the chancellery and so on. So people know. People are not naive, and people are not stupid. And they know that there are, long-term goals that the U.S. had in occupying Iraq, and not just, as I say, whatever that liberation sort of means. So nobody expects any dramatic change. I think the question is, for the Iraqis, when you ask them who is going to take over and how is that going to happen, it's a dark screen. I have to ask that question over and over and over, focus groups, people on the street, and so on. Nobody has any clue as to what is going to happen in 6 months or how, the political situation is going to look like. And that is very depressing for
well,
me.
Look, listening to our Iraqi colleague Mudaffar and Amal, I mean, let's also be realistic here. It's entirely possible that the United States has all kind of nefarious desires and objectives in relation to oil and whatever you want. But the realities, I think, are that you will have to have Americans, whether you like it or not, simply to maintain such security as is possible. It's very important, in fact, that Iraqis stand up their own security forces and take over responsibility for security in the country. But if you want an immediate pullout of troops, that may precipitate you into a civil war, which would be even worse than what you have on already. Secondly, and I think this is a crucial point, I do think that, Iraqis have every reason to resent this occupation. It reminds them too much of an occupation nearby. I understand all of that. But the solution has to be Iraqis beginning to take responsibility for their country, wresting it, seizing it, if necessary, from the Americans. You mustn't talk as if the only people who are going to determine outcomes in Iraq are the Bush administration. This is your country. After June 30th, I'm under no illusions that you're going to get sovereignty, but you can have sovereignty if you seize it, if you take it, if you insist that this is your country, if you insist that it's your oil, if you insist that you're going to run it your way. I genuinely believe, maybe here I'm naive, that the Americans, frankly, given the disasters that have unfolded, would be only too happy to hand the country back to you. I mean, and so it's now up to you is the point. And it's, believe me, I know how difficult it's going to be, but it can be done. And sitting back and condemning the Americans is entirely justified, but it's not going to get you your country back.
No, I'm not doing a blanket condemnation of America. I have worked with absolutely I have great admiration for a large number of civil affairs officers with whom I have worked very closely. I think the negative side of this whole thing has been, is what the media focuses on. I have great story. They may be anecdotal, but they are, I think, illustrious of the goodwill and the dedication of both civilian and military Americans. And I am absolutely respectful and, admire that. So I'm not condemning in general, policy issues apart. What I'm saying is, yes, we speak about political elite, and the Iraqis will obviously one day take over their own, country and their own future into their hands. But for me, what I've seen in this last year is that there is no room now on the public arena for any Iraqis, if you like, who are moderate, who are more, secular, who have certain vision for a united nation. There is no room for them now to come out. I don't think the CPA has tried to make, this is, again, my own feeling, a great effort to reach out for these people.
Just a quick answer, Amal, because we're coming up to a break. But if there had been another 60,000 American soldiers there from last May or June, would that have provided the level of security to give the moderates that space to earn credits with the people?
I think if they were trained and if they did provide security, yes, I think these people may have sort of come out on the public scene, if you like. And if the CPA was more inclined to listen to them. But then again, I that's how I feel.
1-800-423-8255. Your chance to join the conversation this hour about democracy in Iraq. What happens in the next 40 days? What happens after the 30th of June? What responsibility does the U.S. have for the state of affairs now? And what should the role of the United States be after the 30th of June? 1-800-423-TALK. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection from NPR. I'm Dick Gordon. You're listening to The Connection from National Public Radio. In the newspapers in this country today, new photographs from the prison showing abuse in Abu Ghraib, more accusations about the way that the American military intelligence mistreated people in that institution and elsewhere. Our number is 1-800-423-8255. As we look ahead to the 30th of June, we're asking, what are the prospects for democracy in Iraq and whose responsibility, who holds responsibility for that? We're going to go to Columbia, South Carolina, and is it Myra joining us? Hi, Myra.
Hi. I wanted to make a point that initially I, with some reservation, supported the war in Iraq because of the potential of weapons of mass destruction and the instability and grandiosity of Saddam Hussein. However, in light of what's happened since the initial invasion, I think that the Iraqis need to take responsibility for much of what's happening. Instead of playing the victim and instead of making demands constantly, why don't they've got thousands of former military troops, why don't they start forming block brigades and patrol their own blocks, let them start, finding these, weapons that are everywhere, let them, round them up, take them in. Why don't they take some responsibility for stabilizing their own government? And
You're talking about stabilizing their own neighborhoods. Let's keep it at a simple sort of manageable level, Myra. Mm-hmm. Don't go anywhere. Just stay with me on this. I want to hear Amal on whether or not that's even possible.
Well, that actually did take place both during the invasion and right after it and up to now. Many neighborhoods, I speak only in Baghdad because that's where my experience has been, many neighborhoods in Baghdad formed their own security, if you like, and they guarded the neighborhoods. They prevented looting from taking place. They also got together, cooperated, and bought generators last summer when we had no electricity to serve the neighborhood. So they formed neighborhood groups both for their own protection and for mutual assistance. That absolutely has taken place.
So to the point that Myra's making, Amal, about taking in a larger sense, just taking responsibility for the country?
In a larger sense, they don't have the, they are not in power. I mean, the Iraqis recognize very well that the effective, that that the it is Mr. Bremer who is the president of Iraq. He can abrogate laws, which he does. He can put laws into effect. He is the commander, if you like, both in this in all senses. So the Iraqis can take responsibility at a neighborhood level, at a district level. But I think she's talking about much larger issues. There is no army in Iraq. The army was disbanded immediately, and that was perhaps one of the big problems or mistakes, if you like. There are weapons.
Hang on a second, Amal. I want to let Michael in here for half a second.
I think Amal is capturing a sense of angry powerlessness that many Iraqis feel about the American occupation. But I do think, even though they're not going to get the full substance of sovereignty after June 30th, the dynamic moving forward into 2005 and 2006 is definitely towards self-government. And at that point, it seems to me, Iraqis have got to take this country in both hands and run it. And they're not going to be able to say it's the Americans' fault forever. They've got the oil, they've got the resources, they've got a hugely skilled and talented people with plenty of civic courage, and they're just, you know, they're the only people who can pull this particular truck out of the ditch. I mean, and I think they're going to have more and more capacity to do this. Bremer, whom you're rightly criticizing, is not going to be here after the 30th of June.
To Concord, Massachusetts, and Sydney's on the line. Hi, Sydney.
Hi, I just want to say this is the most insightful discussion on Iraq that I've heard in many a day. And I have a question addressed to Amal. I have been deeply disappointed that there have been so many attacks by Iraqis on Iraqis. Does she have any insight as to why that would happen? It looks like anarchy to me.
It is.
Yeah. Sorry, Amal. Go ahead.
Absolutely. It is anarchy. It is chaos. We don't really have yet any viable court system, no viable police system. The Iraqis, we don't know who is, certainly a number of Iraqis are involved in destabilizing and in murdering other Iraqis, but there are also a large number of non-Iraqis, some extremist people who justify, I say cult almost, people who belong to certain Islamic cultish-like groups, to whom killing other Muslims or other Iraqis is justified from their own extreme ideological viewpoint. They have been throwing grenades and bombs at children, at women and men, and old and young.
But I can imagine it being quite a difficult thing, even for you, Amal, as well as the people who have lived there under Saddam Hussein, to come to the recognition at some point over the past year that it wasn't all people from outside. That, you know, for example, in April and in November, the two times when I was there, and there were shootings and car bombings and killings, people would say, Iraqis will not do this to other Iraqis. But the recognition has come that, in fact, there are some very bad Iraqis.
Absolutely. And I don't think any Iraqi, to go back to Professor Ignatieff's, I don't think all Iraqis are just blaming the United States. Certainly the Iraqis I talk to and I come in contact with, they blame Iraq is just as much, if you like, and they blame other Arabs and interfering and Iranians and so on. I don't think it's all scapegoating the United States. And that has not happened.
I think that's absolutely true, Amal. And I think the other thing to say is that America has to take responsibility for what America is responsible for. And the only people responsible for what happened in Abu Ghraib are Americans. I mean, everybody has to take their responsibilities here. One of the things that makes Abu Ghraib such a moral catastrophe is that you can't go in there promising you're going to liberate a country for the sake of human rights if you abuse human rights in the process. That's the first thing. And the second thing is, it indicates, you know, that Abu Ghraib is the tip of a much, much bigger iceberg of detention centers that are just out of control and are not subject to the rule of law. And that is a real cancer that is eating at the very heart of the legitimacy of a war on terror. You can't win a war on terror if you're abusing human rights in the process. Because a war on terror is a battle for hearts and minds. We've lost moral credit among hundreds and hundreds of millions of people we desperately need to have on our side.
Use the term in your book, a sort of moral narcissism, which when I looked at that, sort of drew me back to the Abu Ghraib situation, where people, if I'm getting it right, Michael, people who have such a blind belief in whatever they say being better than whatever is, will behave in a way that is completely unacceptable.
Well, there is a kind of moral narcissism in this administration. They just think they can make up the rules, and the rules that they make up are self-evidently right, and that the necessity to beat the insurrection in Iraq justifies almost anything, any inhumanity, any degrading abuse. And we've just really got to wake up, because it is possible. I mean, we have to get clear about this. It is possible to lose a war on terror, and Abu Ghraib is the surest way I know to lose it.
And Amal, I'm wondering if we reflect on the discredit that the U.S. carries as a result of Abu Ghraib and other incidents. Does that mean that the other agencies that the U.N. would play a principal role in will be equally discredited? I mean, the U.N. can't lift its right arm without the U.S. there, that NATO can't move without the U.S. And as was the point that was made earlier in the program, is Iraqis aren't stupid. They know this. They know that those other agencies have to operate with the strength and the power and the agreement of the United States. So if they come in, will they be equally discredited?
Well, maybe as I don't need to point out, the UN does not have a great record over the last 12 years in Iraq with the oil for food scandal and the and the fraud that has gone. I mean, the Iraqis still told me the first week I was there, the UN took $1 billion disappeared somewhere, you know. So they don't have that great a record, but it's a faute de mieux, you know. There isn't really much else, and the UN might come in as sort of a broker for the US, as you say, and Iraqis are basically the majority. Are basically practical people. They have suffered enough. All they want, as they say, is to have a job, to have security, to get married, to have children, to have, you know, the usual things.
Let's go to
so
Louisville.
I think they're willing.
Let's go to Louisville, Kentucky. Steve's with us from there. Hi, Steve. Thanks for calling.
Hi. Thank you. I wanted to thank Amal for her insight and offer a prayer that her heart will be renewed in the process. I also wanted to ask, where does she see, and Mike too, where do they see the need for going forward? What needs to happen next to make this a success, rather than looking back at what could have been done differently?
Well, Amal, you're up first. Are you going back to Iraq in any time soon?
Well, I hope so. I really hope so. I do want to go back and keep working on establishing democracy, on elections, hopefully, on continuing this initiative. I have no doubt in my mind, but I think I will wait another 6-7 months to see.
You made one point, Amal, that I want to ask you about, and that was that earlier in a conversation with one of the people I work with, that if the United States had not closed down the newspaper that Muqtadir al-Sadr's people had, that they wouldn't be fighting the insurgency in Karbala and in Najaf and everywhere in the south. And I'm wondering, based on that point, whether or not after June 30th, if there's a little bit more Iraqi wisdom in approving those kinds of decisions, that kind of seeing events spin out of control can also be prevented.
I think so. I think there was really no reason to close the Al-Hawza. I mean, it was subversive, it was inflammatory, but it wasn't read by that many people. And people said, why provoke?
People call us subversive and inflammatory, and we're
why provoke?
God bless you for it.
I think you're absolutely right, and I think,
okay, then Michael, if in the days ahead there is a little bit more Iraqi input into the decisions that are made in governing the country, if we use that as an example. Is this an administration or is this an occupation? Is there the wherewithal within, you know, everything that's been learned over the past year to go, okay, maybe we're not right on this. Maybe we need to take somebody else's advice on this.
Well, I'm not sure. I simply don't know. This team may be so embedded in its own mistakes that it can't self-correct. The thing I've wanted to say the whole hour is let's not lose faith with the Iraqi people. Let's not lose faith with the political wisdom they've already displayed. I mean, the reality is we don't have civil war because the Kurds have behaved responsible, because Ali Sistani, the Shia leader, has behaved responsibly. We have some political leadership who've stood up and tried to work in the governing council, even though two of their members have been killed. You know, we forget too easily the number of Iraqis like my fellow guest who've stood up courageously for democracy. The thing I'm worried about is that as the country tips against this war, as we begin to lose faith with it, we will betray the people in whom we put our trust and confidence, namely the Democrats in Iraq who want a decent society. There are a lot of them on the ground. This is a great country and a great people, and they deserve better than being abandoned. And I think if we can drive that political process, there is no military solution here. There's only a political solution, which is to drive it towards, you know, a constitution, elections, a fully democratic election at the end of 2005, early 2006. We may just get there, but we're not going to get there if we cut and run. We're not going to get there if we give up on people who've shown a great deal more courage and faith in democracy than some of us have done.
Michael, thanks so much for coming in. Michael Ignatieff is director of the Carr Center for Human Rights at Harvard University, author of a new book called The Lesser Evil. Take some of these ideas a little bit further. And Amal Rassam, thank you so much for coming in.
Thank you.
Amal is a retired professor of anthropology at the City University of New York. We spent the last year in Iraq helping to build civil society there, and as you just heard, plans to go back and continue that work. We'll stay in touch with both her and Michael. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection.